I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Mark Liren Young joins me again. He's just published a new book, Octopus Ocean, Geniuses of the Deep. Mark has taken a deep dive into the world of octopuses, and what a book has come as a result. In it, the reader learns about how magnificent these animals are, known for their brilliant minds and unique personalities. You'll learn about how they prefer to be alone, how they can manipulate others, including other species. They're able to distract as well as collapse their bodies to fit in small spaces, or better yet, escape. They're intelligent beings, are just fascinating to behold. They're also creatures who seem to always make news, as research reveals something new all the time. I'll ask Mark about what it's like to see them up close. We'll talk about writing for younger readers as well as hockey. It's such an enjoyable book. You'll learn lots, and there's enough here to make you an expert at octopuses. Mark Liren Young is an award-winning author, screenwriter, playwright, and filmmaker. He has written television shows for young viewers and wrote, directed, and produced the award-winning documentary, The 100-Year-Old Whale. He is the host of the Scanna podcast. Visit liren-young.com for more. This new book is published by Orca Books. We spoke a week and a half ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Mark Liren Young. Mr. Liren Young, good morning.
Good morning.
I guess it's good afternoon where we're talking, but...
but this sounds, you know, you don't know when it's going to air.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and old habits are hard to live down, I guess. I can't.
It's 9 o'clock somewhere.
It is, exactly. 9 a.m. somewhere. 9 a.m. precisely is someone, you know, who had a microphone in this town once used to say. I was telling you before we started how much I enjoyed Octopus Ocean, because I sat with it, and as I was reading it, I kept putting it on my lap and then looking up things online on my phone. It's so encouraging in that way. You go back to even the endnotes, look up articles that you cite. It's such an engaging book like that. I mean, you must have had fun writing it. I mean, did you?
This is so much fun. Also, now you understand. I mean, you were very kind saying that you were willing to read a digital version, but now
that's right.
That you've seen it,
You
understand. Was like, no, you have to see this.
It's a beautiful book, too. Yeah.
Thanks. The octopus are just so freaking beautiful.
Yeah.
I had so much fun with this, and it was so wild because the other books that I've written for Orca, I'd spent years writing about orcas before I wrote books about orcas. I had known Rob Stewart for a very long time and followed his work before I wrote the shark book. Octopuses seriously just came out of Orca going, what would you like to do next? And my wife going, octopuses are really cool. I'm going, I don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
You know, I know they're cool, but, you know, I'm coming at them completely cold. And in a weird way, that made it so much fun. It gave me an excuse to go to the top experts in the world and going, okay, tell me the coolest things. And I went into an elementary school here in Victoria and talked to students there and said, okay, what do you know about octopuses? What do you wish you knew about octopuses? So I just sort of came at this one with pure curiosity.
Yeah.
So much fun to write.
And then I was reading it, you know, thinking I knew, you know, I knew enough about them, or, you know, I knew what I wanted to know about them. And then I found myself completely entranced by them because they're just such fascinating creatures. I guess the first thing I should ask you is, you know, I always thought that the plural for octopus was octopi.
That was real interesting. Oh, yes, I was read the Riot Act on that by multiple experts who basically said, no, octopi is, you know, basically bad grammar.
Mm-hmm.
It's misunderstanding the roots of the word. And it's become common because it does sound really cool.
Yeah.
But every time I spoke with an octopus expert, they're like, octopuses. And the first time I'd ever heard that was in a fact check, I think for Orcas Everywhere.
Mm.
And whoever the proofreader was said, no, it's not octopi. I'm like, what do you mean it's not octopi? And that sort of didn't quite stick in my head until talking to the octopus experts were like, no, you have to fix that. There were a handful of things they were like, yep, these are common misperceptions. Make sure you deal with them in the book.
I wish I could find that elementary school teacher who told me that years ago.
Ditto.
You know,
because I was absolutely raised with the idea that octopi was a thing.
Yeah.
And there, with each of these books, there's like one thing out there that people are determined to correct me on. And this one is octopi. I'm like, no, seriously, I'm talking to, you know, the experts. Yeah. You know, like, everybody's citing, and they're going, no, he's octopi, not a thing.
Yeah. Well, see, the other thing I thought about as I was reading the book and thinking back to everything that I possibly knew before I even read the book was that that octopuses were somehow related to squids. Are they?
Yes, but they're not as similar as I thought they were.
Mm.
I mean, they're still basically the same. This is where I feel off balance scientifically because I want to say family, which, if you're a scientist, has different meanings.
Yeah.
But they're basically coming from the same world, but they're not the same species. They're very much a different thing. They are built differently. And even when I was writing the book, I had people going, do you really want to put squid in here? Because you're going to confuse people. I'm like, yeah, but the fact that I'm going to confuse people is why I want to put them in. Right, the fact that I had assumed octopuses have tentacles, you know, my entire life.
Yeah.
And people were thinking, no, tentacles are a squid thing. Here's how they work. Here's what they are. I thought anything that is confusing me as an adult, I want to make sure I deal with in this book. And I mean, squid are also fascinating. And like the idea that. I get into this a lot in the book about the new stuff we're seeing. The idea that we just, as we are saying this, as we're having this conversation, we just saw giant squid swimming in their own habitat. Like, there's footage that came out, like, days ago.
Yeah.
That, to me, is so amazing. The idea that we are still discovering things about what is underneath the ocean. And the only fact check that I intentionally chose to not accept when I had scientists reading the book was one of them said, I have in the book, we will never know how many octopus are up there.
Mm.
And the scientist who is pretty much the octopus scientist on the planet said, I believe we will. And I'm like, you know what? You're telling me there are octopus out there that are the size, essentially, a drop of water. Like, they're microscopic freaking octopuses. We do not know our oceans that well. I think there's always going to be a new discovery out there in the oceans. We're always going to go, oh, wow, who knew that?
Yeah.
The number of new discoveries while I was writing this book. I did this with the shark book, too.
Yeah.
And I did Orca. I just went, you know what? I'm going to put all of my focus on information from the last 2 years. And I basically went to Smithsonian, Scientific American, Nat Geo, and went, what have you published, and what are you publishing right now on these animals? Because we just kept discovering new stuff. Like, as I was writing this book, every day I was reading this book, it felt like there was a new discovery going, oh, we had no idea that octopus is hanging out here. Oh, here's another species. Oh, here's another kind of giant Pacific octopus. It's so amazing to me. And part of that is just the tech's so much better, right?
Yeah.
So we've got underwater tech, and we're also paying more attention.
Yeah. Are humans the biggest threat to octopuses?
We're the biggest threat to everything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we really are it. You know, and octopuses, I mean, this was also weird for me because I'm used to writing about endangered species. And it was very odd, you know, dealing with octopus experts. No, octopus are ridiculously adaptable. You know, when they start moving to new areas, it's the other animals in the new areas that are going to have to worry more than they do.
Mm.
So they're not, in some ways, they're not facing the same types of threats as almost everything else because they're really freaking adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
But we are so messing with, well, we're messing with everybody's environment, so we're definitely messing with their environment.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking about is, you know, because there were a lot of, you know, I mean, I've seen octopus on a number of different kinds of menus in the city. And, you know, in terms of what we're consuming, is there a way to consume them better, say, or more sustainably? I mean, you talk about farming in the book, and I found that interesting. That's not farming octopuses is not exactly the solve either, is it?
Oh, that was stunning to me. Again, speaking to experts and going, you know, why is this a bad idea? It's like, because these animals are solitary.
Mm.
So if you look at essentially the entire anti-captivity movement around orcas and cetaceans, which is an area I've spent a lot of time, it comes down to you cannot isolate these incredibly intelligent social animals. That's just cruel. Then you get to octopuses, mm-hmm. and it's just the opposite. You cannot take these incredibly solitary animals and put them in the tank with somebody else. They are not wired that way. And so you've got a whole different set of problems there. And everybody I spoke to who speaks fluent octopus was going, no, this is just, you know, they didn't buy any of the science that was being cited on how these animals were going to be treated. But it was wild working on this book and, say, visiting Storm, who's the star of the book, so visiting this giant Pacific octopus out in Sydney, and then, you know, driving into town and going to local supermarket and seeing pieces of octopus on sale in the fish section. And, again, if somebody's done a lot of work around endangered species, my first default reaction is this is wrong. And, but they're not, they are not, to the best of our knowledge, endangered in any of the same ways that most of the animals we're worried about out there are endangered. And everything freaking eats them.
Yeah.
Right, like that was the other shock. You know, Dana Stoff, who I interviewed for my podcast, Scanna, but really interviewing for this book, was talking about basically squid being the protein bars of the sea.
Mm.
Right? If an animal wants to survive, you start looking for squid. And octopuses have pretty much the same rap, where it's just like, yeah, you want a good, nutritious meal, it's going to get you through your day, and you're living in the water, that's your food source. And the fact that octopuses also go, oh, I'm hungry, there's a smaller octopus.
Yeah.
That looks like lunch.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. And then the other thing I was thinking about was, I don't know where I learned this growing up. Maybe it was through a comic book or something like that, that they regrow, say, if an arm gets chopped off by something or some other species, can they regrow? Can they regenerate?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the other reasons that I think, or this is one of the reasons that I think, some scientists are really reluctant to hold their research with octopuses up to the same standards as other animals, because I suspect they're messing around with regeneration, right? I suspect they're doing things like cutting things off. And it sounds like you and I have basically the same, you know, core background in science, where it's like, yep, we both learned that from Spider-Man. I'm kind of betting. Yeah, the regeneration is fascinating, but so much is fascinating. Like, almost every single person I talked to, and I went to so many experts, kind of went, yeah, if they live longer, they're the apex animal on the planet.
Yeah, I mean,
They are ridiculous. The level of intelligence, I can't even wrap my head around it.
Yeah, even
through the whole book, I couldn't wrap my head around it.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book where you talk about, say, if they're fighting with another species and a piece of their arm gets bitten off, it can still move, thereby distracting the predator so that the octopus can, say, you know, fly, or not fly, but, you know, swim away. Which, again, is just another fascinating thing about how they're able to, say, maneuver through a predatory sea as they do.
Well, the thing that I had so much trouble wrapping my head around was the idea that basically they pop out of the egg, their parents are gone, and they just go, oh, it's my world. I've got this wired. It is, like, it is mind-blowing to me. Like, if you've watched my octopus teacher, which it felt like everyone in the world had when I started this book, That octopus builds freaking armor. This is an octopus thing.
Yeah.
They build armor. They use stuff as weapons. When I was doing this book, I can't even remember what side it came out on. There had been a study showing that octopus were training other fish to hunt with them. And I think, and one of my expert fact checkers, and this is one of the experts in the world, went, yeah, I don't know about that one. I think you may be off base. And I'm like, no, no, this study. And when the book was coming out, study after study was now proving the same thing.
Yeah.
The octopuses put together freaking hunting parties. But they basically go, okay, dude, you're now my hunting dog. You're now basically my horse. You're my hunting falcon. Like, they're, and if you step on a line, they punch you.
Yeah.
That is, seriously, that is impossible. Like, you just look at that and go, what? You're putting together a posse of other animals to make it easier for you to hunt? You're this animal that has a reputation for being entirely unsocial, but you figured out how to train up partners or, you know, or a hunting posse or whatever term you want to go with. But they're training up other undersea animals to work for them.
Yes,
and they're definitely working for them, not with them.
Yeah, then see, I went into the book thinking, you know, that it was cool that they could camouflage themselves, which they do.
Oh.
But, I mean, you know, that they would use shells or other things that they found to cover up themselves or to, you know, guard against for their benefit. It's just fascinating, and it is exciting to read that in the book. You mentioned Storm. This octopus that you met in Sydney, there just north of Victoria. And getting behind the scenes at the aquarium just sounds like just fun days
cool.
for you. Yeah. So what was it like when you got to shake hands with Storm? Can you describe what your hand felt like?
Oh, I mean, I'm getting shivers just having you ask that question. It was so bizarre because this is Shaw Centre for the Salish Sea in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a really interesting policy. I was unable to find out how unique this was. I was unable to find anyone else who has this policy. But because they're located in pretty much the same part of the world where you get giant Pacific octopuses, and giant Pacific octopuses are the octopus of choice for kind of all aquariums because, A, they're big,
mm-hmm.
and, B, they live longer than most octopuses. They live 3.5 to 5 years, really likely, more likely around 4.
Yeah.
So, which is weirdly long for an octopus. So, but because this place is located where it is, and because whoever runs it made this choice ages ago, they only keep the octopuses for 6 months.
Mm.
They take them out of the water, are very careful with who they introduce them to, and then go back into the ocean. Live out your octopus life. Go make more octopuses. Which is not your standard aquarium drill at all, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So Storm was supposed to be going out to an aquarium in Iceland. A storm basically canceled the flight, which is where the name comes from, and the delay was so long, they went, you know what? There are a lot of octopuses out there in the sea. You've got this one in temp holding in Sydney. Why don't you just keep this one? We'll find a new one.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Storm was, I'd met the previous octopus, Sequin. Sequin was kind of, it's interesting, because Sequin was kind of flashy.
Mm.
Sequin tends to be doing stuff when I visited them. Really what I wanted to get a handle on was how people watch them. So I would go out and I would watch kids responding to octopuses, and I'd listen to their questions, their parents. And when I got a moment, I'd go to the people who gave the tours and the volunteers. And so what do people ask? You know, what do people want to know? And they said, you know, they all want to ask something they learned at my octopus teacher was basically the question, you know, what I heard. But I'd been doing this for 6-7 months when they were getting ready to return Storm. And I oddly lucked out. Because Storm could not return again because of the weather, because we were having fires hit, and they could not get Storm back home right away.
Mm.
So they allowed me backstage, basically, and Storm reached an arm. My brain still wants to say tentacle, but reached an arm up. And, you know, put, like, the tip of her arm, the suckers from the tip of her arm, uh-huh. which were like cherry pits, on my finger, and sort of checked me out, like, oh, what are you? Are you tasty? Are you interesting?
Yeah.
You're the guy who's been watching me for 6 months. And I have no doubt about, because they're really good with figuring out who we are.
Mm.
Like, there's so many stories about them knowing exactly who was watching them. So I think I visited enough that she's like, yeah, I've seen you out there. What do you want? And she kind of reached out, grabbed my finger, checked me out for just a little bit, and then went, you know, I'm eating the crab now, dude, so I'm done. But nice to finally meet you. And disappeared. And I basically left almost immediately, walked into the nearest diner, went, give me a Diet Coke, leave me alone, and wrote the introduction to the book.
Wow.
Well, the sensations were still fresh, while I could still accurately describe what it felt like, because I went, this is magic. And, you know, part of that was inspired, it's a wonderful book by Cy Montgomery, where she wrote about meeting octopuses and the experiences of going, oh, wow, there's another mind here.
Mm.
There's another being here. And I just felt so phenomenally lucky that here I was writing a kid's book about octopuses, and I was able to do the same thing and go, I've met one.
Yeah. So did it feel like it was sucking your finger, or did it feel sticky?
No, it felt neat. Mm. Like it felt like I was being checked out. Like it felt like I was being, and I don't think I knew at the time that basically that's how they taste things. That's how they sense the world. They sense the world in so many different ways, but they also do taste through those suckers. So getting a handle on that, getting a handle on whatever octopuses want to know about us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, it's really great to read the book and then get a sense of how you're getting a sense of just how big their brains are.
Yes.
And how intelligent they are amongst all the species that we know about. You know, we tend to think that something intelligent is social, and yet these creatures are not, are they? Which is another fascinating thing, because you're trying to balance the two, and you're thinking, well, you know, you assume because one thing is this thing is this way, it's going to also be this way, but they're their own thing, aren't they? Their own unique.
Well, this is one of the things that blew my mind. Was the number of, if you look up most intelligent animals on Earth besides us,
mm-hmm.
pretty much everything else that falls into that category is a very social animal, right? They are social animals, family structures. They're elephants whose family structures look just like ours, right? Like, you know, you look at elephants, apes, orcas, and, you know, you're looking at complex matrilineal societies that hang out, look out for each other, communicate with each other, and then you hit the freaking octopuses. And they hang out alone. And if they run into each other, they're just as likely to eat each other as say hi.
Mm.
And, you know, what was one of my favorite conversations was with Dr. Jennifer Mather, who, you know, I think she said it in pretty much every study on octopuses everywhere. She was a scientific advisor of my octopus teacher. And she was invited to talk alien intelligence with SETI, the place that discovers alien intelligence, because they started to realize we've got alien intelligence on Earth. Right? We've got a form of intelligence that does not track with other kinds of intelligence. Like, it's just, they're so absolutely their own thing. The octopus, you know, just because we're on intelligence, I don't want to forget this.
Mm-hmm.
The mimic octopus is absolutely impossible to me, right? You and I both interviewed people forever. I was lucky enough to interview André-Philippe Gagnon when he was the top mimic human being in the world.
Yeah.
And his, you know, his most famous bit, I kept thinking of him, and I thought, it's too old a reference, and it won't work for kids, but it'll work for you and me.
Yeah.
And his most famous bit was doing all of We Are the World and doing every single thing. And it's like, yeah, okay. He, you know, and unlike most performers, he actually did some facial expressions, right? He didn't just do voices.
Yeah.
As good as he was, the mimic octopus beats him every possible way, right? Like, they change the texture of their skin. They change the way they swim. So we know that octopuses can change colors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mimic's got that wired, so do the rest of them. But this one changes shape, the way that it's, the way they swim, the way they move, everything about them suddenly presents as something that is either going to scare something they want to eat,
yeah,
or scare something that wants to eat them, or help them catch a thing. They are seriously impossible. Right? Like, I just look and go, how in the world do you exist?
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the, how they mimic things. So, like, take for example a stingray, which would probably, you know, sting something to attack another species.
Yeah.
Do octopuses use their ink in the same sort of way?
They use their ink in all sorts of different ways. And one of the things that's interesting, historically, the assumption was they squirted because they were scared.
Mm.
And it's really come together that no, it's strategy. There's nothing that they do that is random.
Yeah.
And, like, they're using their ink specifically to hide, to hunt. There's a reason for it.
To distract, right?
Yeah. And I think, really, you know, humans are historically uncomfortable with the idea that animals have strategy or animals have agency.
Yeah.
So I get it if, you know, if you're a scientist, you're going, yeah, this is totally a reaction to, and not, this is clearly this animal thinking things through. Like, the escape stories that I found, the way that they would go, I know how to sneak out of the cage, but I don't want to go anywhere, so I'm going to sneak back into the cage after I've eaten something next door.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you've seen Finding Dory, where you watch the octopus do this, like, yes, that's what they do. They know how to do that. Like, that is just, it's mind-blowing. They're mind-blowing.
Yeah, you know, I've seen that video, I'm sure everyone has, of the octopus escaping the boat. Yeah, through a very little hole. You've got a photo in the book of an octopus squeezing into a rusty can, and you know these are huge things, and yet they manage to get themselves so small in such a small space. I still can't understand that. Even after seeing a video or seeing a photo in your book or the explanation in the book, you know.
The octopus in New Zealand who was taught to take pictures of the visiting tourists, Rambo, like. Oh my! I would have gone to New Zealand just to have my photo taken by Rambo.
Yeah.
Right. I was like, oh my God, this octopus has figured this out, and again, figured it out so quickly. I was like, oh, you like that? Yeah, I can do that. No big deal.
Yeah.
So, right? Like, not this took years to learn.
Yeah.
Took a couple of tries and went, oh, sure, I can do that.
Yeah.
This isn't boring. I'll try that. And the thing that kills me that happened after the book. I don't know if you've seen the stories about the sharktopus.
No.
I put this on a Scana Substack. So a New Zealand octopus hitches a ride on a shark. And not just any shark, because octopus are awesome. On the back of the Mako shark, which is the fastest shark out there, and I'm going, yeah, of course, if you're an octopus and you want to ride somewhere, yeah, hop a Mako shark. No messing around with slower sharks.
No.
You're gonna go right for the speedboat. Like, the first thing that I would add, if this book were to get a reprint tomorrow, the picture of the sharktopus.
Yeah. This is the fun part of the book, is because, you know, we don't know everything. Not everything is in here.
No.
We have to go back and you know, keep up to date. I'm sure there'll be a lot of readers who will start a Google alert or something like that about octopuses. That way they have it in their inbox as soon as something new comes up, right?
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, I think I can't remember if I put it in the introduction. They definitely put it in the book.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Seriously, stop reading right now
and Google.
Look up new octopus discovery, and it's possible something just happened between the moment you picked up the book 5 minutes ago and now.
Yeah.
Because we're learning so much about them.
What is it like, Mark, to write for younger readers? And you know, I've asked you this before because it's different to write for a younger reader than an adult. But knowing that you get to convey information that they might get for the first time, I'm sure there'll be a young reader who'll read this book and then, because of what they've read in it, might be inspired by, you know, to study something in the ocean as a result. I mean, do you think about that as you're writing, say?
I don't, because it blows my mind when it happens. I mean, I haven't been doing the animal stuff for that long, right? My life took a really interesting turn in 2015 when I started writing about orcas. And I've now met people, because 2015 is, you know, just a while ago for me. It's not a while ago if you're 20.
Yeah.
And I've now met 20-year-olds and teenagers who are like, yeah, I'm studying marine biology, or I'm working on Saturna Island watching the whales because I read your book.
Wow.
Oh, my God, is that overwhelming. Like, that is just, that is not something I imagined having a part in, right? And so when I take on a topic like this, it's, I just kind of go to, how can I make you care? What are you interested in? How can I make you care more? How can I make this not this the first book you read about octopuses, and now you're going to go read Cy Montgomery's book, and now you're going to read Dennis Stauff's book, and now you're going to keep going. And so my goal is to, with these, is to sort of be the gateway so that these kids want to keep reading and want to keep doing this. So it really is me going, you know, like we're saying, I'm a comic book guy, right? Like, I need to be entertained, right? I grew up on freaking Stan Lee, man. And so I'm looking to go, what's the bit that would excite me? And all the way through, that's what I'm looking for. It's like, what'll make them want to read more? And the other thing that's really interesting and challenging, I have no science background, right? I've got a degree. I've got a freaking double major in theater and creative writing. You know, I've got, like, I think that may actually functionally qualify as the least scientific degree you can get at a university, right? So I have to work with scientists going, do I have this right? And I'm starting from a much lower baseline than most people, because I'm going, no, that term that you take for granted, I've never heard it before, right? So they're coming at me with terms that they all learned in first year or second year marine biology. And I'm going, no, you don't understand. I really didn't take marine biology. So you've got to walk me through. So in that way, I feel like coming into this cold works so well for the kids' books.
Yeah.
Because I'm going, you know, the one that that always sticks out for me is when I was writing about whales for the first time, I could not wrap my head around the concept of baleen. I could not get past the idea that the biggest animals on Earth did not have teeth. Mm. It legit did not compute for me. And I had this wonderful marine biology student at the University of Victoria just walk me through again and again. And I would write an explanation, and poor Lily would come back to me and go, no, it's not quite right. And I'd go, okay, what am I getting wrong? And she'd send me back an explanation, and her explanation would include 8 words they didn't know, or that would also require explaining. And then I'd go back, and we'd go back and forth until we've removed every piece of scientific jargon. Because, wait, you don't understand, I can't explain this. I can't explain scientific jargon with more scientific jargon. Right, and as true as that was for the killer whale who changed the world, that's so much more true for kids' books. So I'm coming at this not assuming a knowledge of these words, right? And I think if you're coming from a science background, you're assuming a knowledge of different words than I assume, because you were raised on them. They're just part of your wiring. And I will hit a science term and I'm going, I think I know what that means, but I need to double check. And if I only think I know what that means, I'm going to try and remove the jargon. So I'm very, very conscious of trying to walk through and explain every concept because I needed somebody to explain it to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm too old now to get into my marine biology, but because I've read this book, at the next dinner party, I'm going to be Cliff Clavin and rattle off facts that, you know, will probably tire everybody.
Oh, I love that. Well, I mean, one of the things that was most amazing with this book is the fact that Craig Foster, who is the star of My Octopus Teacher, read it. And again, I think when most people are looking for blurbs, they're just looking for somebody to say something nice. I'm like, no, I want them to read the book and see if there are any errors. Mm. It's like I'm choosing people who don't, especially with this book, I'm like, everybody reading it knows more than me. If I'm going out and you've written books about octopuses, I trust that you know stuff that I don't. And so going to them and going, all right, what have you found? I think he found two things. He was like, yeah, are you sure about this? And are you sure about this? So having him go through it and go, yeah, this is on, maybe look into this. There's something, and so often what I had wrong was right 6 months earlier.
Mm.
Right? So it wasn't that that was a really interesting thing with this book. So it wasn't that my research was incorrect.
Yeah.
It was that I had found something from the way back time of 2023, and in 2024, they found out that this wasn't quite true. Like, as I was writing this, there were fights going on about whether octopus can dream, right? Because there were studies showing up going, can an octopus dream? Can an octopus not dream? So depending on who was reading the book, they were like, yeah, this looks sketchy to me, or you're not as far along as this person is. So that was fascinating. And making the calls on, no, this looks to be, trying to be really clear on this is what this person thinks.
Yeah.
Because I'd be listening to other scientists who are like, yeah, I want one more study before I'm good making this jump.
Yeah.
Right. So, just so cool.
To change subjects just for a moment, I've known you over the years as a huge Canucks fan, and you've been a Canucks fan, I would assume, your whole life.
Oh, yes.
How is it that because I've only had a passing interest in this team in recent years, the last couple of years. How is it that you're able to, say, maintain that fandom when they seem to break your heart every season somehow, some way?
This year was extra special on the heartbreak scale. Now, just I'll keep it in the book world for you.
Yeah.
I've actually been up to write two different books about the Vancouver Canucks over the years. I was one of the writers shortlisted to do a Pavel Bure, I can't remember what they were going to call it, an autobiography or a biography, but I was going to write a book about Pavel Bure at the height of his stardom. And I lost that deal, but I lost the deal right before he had the bad injury and left Vancouver. So that was kind of a blessing. But I was also, and this is still heartbreaking to say, the year that we went finals game 7, Boston Bruins, which, by the way, I was at that game live in the arena. So my heartbreak was in real time.
Yeah.
I was there when somebody next to me threw a freaking pop on the ice when Tim Thomas was collecting MVP, getting the Conn Smythe, right? I was downtown for the freaking riot.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife took one of the most memorable photos of the riot for the Taii when I covered it, of people filming the burning car, amazing photo range up. But I was supposed to be writing the book that year about the Canucks run to the Stanley Cup Finals. So I was everywhere because I was set to write the book when we won game 7.
Yeah.
So yes, hardcore. This year, oh my God, The Miller-Pederson soap opera, there's got to be a movie in that. I have no idea what that was about.
Yeah.
But I feel like that broke the team. The idea that Quinn Hughes is probably the best player in the world right now, screw you, Connor McDavid, Quinn Hughes is more fun. If you told me which player I got on my team, I'd choose Quinn Hughes. He was dealing with injuries the entire season, still setting records.
Like, just
you look at that team and go, there are so many storylines. And the crazy thing is I look and go, they could have hobbled into the playoffs and still done damage because they're so weird.
They are so
freaking unpredictable. Like, you look and you go, if anybody told me that Chilov was going to win games for us last year, look like freaking future of the team, show up this year, and not look like an NHL goalie, who saw that coming? Right? Yeah. Like, just plot, it, yeah. So, for sure, plot point frustration or whatever, and I did watch almost every game this year, and they broke my heart almost every game, except that I'd watch Quinn Hughes and go, oh, this is sublime. I get to watch the best player in the world playing for the team I'm cheering for. That's so cool.
And he's such
and
a...
That's,
yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say about Hughes. He's such a remarkable young man. You know, I mean, he reads a lot, and he's a marvelous leader, not just in that locker room, but in the community. That for a young man to have that sort of foisted on him, I don't know how he does it.
I'm with you. One of the things that I find so fascinating and that, you know, makes it pretty tough to quit this team is you look back over the years, and there are teams that have had much better runs, and there are teams that have won a whole lot more Stanley Cups than us, but there has barely been a year in the last few decades when we have not had somebody utterly amazing on the ice. Somebody who made it fun to watch. Even if you're losing, it is, even when the team is tanking, watching Quinn Hughes do something magical is pretty freaking special. Watching Pettersson before whatever happened to him was pretty freaking special. Watching the Sedins throughout their entire career was more fun than watching, I think, the New Jersey Devils for their entire history. Right? Like, just... You could string together 12 games with the Sedins, and I think they'd be more interesting than pretty much anything the Devils did other than lifting Stanley Cups. And, you know, we've just had these phenomenally flashy, amazing players, most of whom seem to have been pretty great human beings, right? So the Sedins, Naslund, Hughes, like, just... So that's the other thing that makes it tough to quit the team. You just go, wow, these guys are special. And the Canucks do seem to have that magical ability to go, yeah, we're going to get somebody on the team who's worth watching. Like, there's always a movie star.
Yeah.
I know that's like, I know I'm switching genres here, but it's like, even if it's a really bad movie, it's a really bad movie starring George Clooney. And I feel like that's what the Canucks have been over and over. Like, it might be a really bad movie, but you get to watch Stan Smeal being Stan Smeal, right? Like, it's just, and most teams have not had that. Most teams have not had a magical, wonderful player, like, really for decades now. I mean, because for a long time we didn't have that. For a long time we were just, like, really entertaining grinders. You know, and, to, like, no lack of good players throughout our history. No lack of even great players throughout our history. But truly special, to want to watch what Alexander McGilvy or Pavel Bure does tonight, those players are rare, and we seem to get them. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
if somebody told me we were going to have five All-Stars last year, and only one of them was going to be playing most of the season this year.
We know that we're talking here on the 19th, and Brock Besser is still a member of the team, at least until, I guess, June 30th. And the writing's on the wall that he's probably not coming back next season. And when they make that announcement, or whenever they make that announcement that he's going somewhere else, hearts will break in this town, won't they?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a guy who's been a star. I guess, what, the 9 seasons that he's been here?
But he's also been a lovely human being.
Mm.
And, I mean, like, I know people who, you know, have much more insider you know, experience with a kind of, it's like, you know, you and I both know reporters, like mm-hmm. we both know media who does stuff. And Besser just keeps coming up with, like, as just a wonderful citizen and human being who's dealt with so much heartbreak and tragedy personally during his time here, that it's like everybody who knows him is rooting for him to be a superstar. So it's not just that he's a player who scores a lot of goals. He's just, by all accounts, a truly lovely human being. So, and blows my mind, he's the longest serving Canuck.
Yeah, and then when he becomes a superstar elsewhere, we're going to wonder what happened during this time and why they couldn't keep him.
Uh-huh. No, I am looking, but really the two guys you couldn't get together to sign were Besser and Pugh Suter.
Yeah.
And Suter basically becomes your number one center. Like, the day after you don't sign him, Suter is effectively your number one center for the remainder of the season.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. That's one of those, if it weren't for bad luck, we'd have none at all, right? You just go, you know, he should have been relatively easy to re-sign. He's not after those last 20 games.
Yeah, yeah. I could talk all day with you about octopuses or hockey or politics. I didn't bother asking about politics now because hockey seems to be more interesting than politics. What are you working on now? Are you working on another book now?
Well, I'm actually working on a book about politics. I've got to keep under wraps for a little longer. So hopefully we'll be back in a few months talking about that, because it's I'm like vaguely sworn to secrecy on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm working about something. Ooh, what can I even say?
It'll be something interesting and something worth reading. And
thank you.
As a fan, I'm going to love it. Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. There
and
you
it's
go.
It's also me being really funny for the first time in a while.
Ah, see, I remember Local Anxiety years ago as a kid. Well, you were a kid too, right? So.
But it's the first time I've basically broken out being political and funny in a long time, you know, so I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I look forward to talking again. Congratulations on this book. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it and how much I learned and how insufferable I'm going to be at the next dinner party telling people everything I know about octopuses now.
I love that so much.
I appreciate your time. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for doing this. And we need to just hang out and talk about this stuff over lunch sometime where neither of us have the microphone running.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be fun, yeah. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Take care. Thank you so much.
The website for more is at liren-young.com. The book is called Octopus Ocean, Geniuses of the Deep. It's published by Orca Books. Its author, Mark Liren-Young, joined me on the line from Saanich in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.